I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the Middle East. Today, the so-called World Court again puts US, EU, UK armed Israel on trial for another genocide-linked case. Tens of thousands, mostly women and children, have been killed by NATO weapons in Gaza, while Russia and China repeatedly vote at the UN Security Council for a ceasefire. Egypt is now wary of Israeli ethnic cleansing of more than a million Palestinians at the Rafah crossing. It's opposed in public even by Joe Biden and his Western European proxies, whose bombs have now attacked Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon and Palestine. Professor Avi Schleim was given the Lifetime Achievement Award by the British Academy, author of the new book, Three Worlds, Memoirs of an Arab Jew. He's Emeritus Professor of International Relations at Oxford University, considered one of Israel's new historians. He joins me now from Oxford. Thank you so much, Professor Schleim, for coming on the show. So,
Very good to be with you.
You've said that the industrial-scale slaughter may have taken Israel to the verge of committing genocide. Why the verge, on what evidence you've so far seen in recent days?
Well, I made this comment quite some time ago when there was some doubt, but today I have no hesitation in saying that what Israel is doing in Gaza amounts to genocide. Genocide is defined by the Prevention of Genocide Convention as the intentional attempt to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic group. And this is precisely what Israel is doing. And for some time, Israel has been pursuing ethnic cleansing on the West Bank, and now they want to do the ethnic cleansing of Gaza as well. And the forcible displacement of civilians is a war crime. So there can be no doubt about this fact, that Israel has been committing war crimes by telling civilians to move against their will. And there are 2.3 million people in Gaza. Israel has already forced 1.1 million of them to move south. Not once, but first Israel told the civilians to move from south to the center, then from the center to the south, then further and further south, and now there are, most of the civilians, about 1.5 million, are concentrated in Rafah on the border for Egypt. So ethnic cleansing is beyond dispute. Genocide, some people may dispute, but a leading Israeli expert in Holocaust study has said that this is a textbook case of genocide. And you don't have to listen to the experts or to me. Look at the ruling of the International Court of Justice, which said that South Africa has made a plausible case of genocide.
Yeah, I want to get on to that. I want to return to Israel in a second, but then if it is, then obviously the last Holocaust was involving Germany. Co-conspirator cases then? I mean, no one is acting as the Genocide Convention mandates. Does that mean and open the way for Britain, Sunak and Biden in the United States and Ursula von der Leyen as co-conspirators, given they are pouring the weaponry without which the genocide could not take place?
I believe that Britain and other European countries who are supplying Israel with weapons are complicit in Israel's war crimes. As for America, I'd like to go further and say that America is not just complicit in Israeli war crimes and in genocide, but America is the enabler of Israeli genocide. And I say this for two reasons. One is that the international community a while ago wanted to order a complete, comprehensive ceasefire. And there was a resolution to that effect in the Security Council. 13 members voted for the resolution. Britain abstained, and the United States used the veto and vetoed this resolution. So we could have had a ceasefire, but for America, who prevented the ceasefire. And secondly, America continues to supply weapons and munitions to Israel. And America could threaten to withhold weapons and munitions, and Israel would have no choice but to stop the fighting. So America is doubly guilty of participation, active participation in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. And it is probably for this reason that Joe Biden has earned himself a new nickname, which is Genocide Joe.
Well, as you know, they are quite open about the fact in the United States and Stoltenberg of NATO that this will improve the job situation in a United States increasingly scarred by disparities of power and wealth. Are there actually comparisons between the Nazi war economy and the massive pumping of billions of tax dollars into the United States economy in terms of manufacturing artillery shells with which to mass murder children in the Middle East?
It's best not to make any comparisons between Nazi Germany and Israel. It's best to look at Israel's record and America's record. It's bad enough, so we don't need to draw any comparisons, and we don't need to exaggerate the scale of the Israeli destruction and carnage in the Gaza Strip. As for the American war economy, it's always been the case that the weapons manufacturers who are located in the south of the United States, in Republican areas, love Israel, because America gives Israel $3.8 billion in military aid a year. So this means that American taxpayers' money goes to Israel as a grant and comes back as a profit to the American military-industrial complex. That's number one. Number two, because Israel is armed with the state-of-the-art equipment, the Arab states want to redress the balance or catch up to some extent and therefore buy American weapons. So somebody makes a profit out of war, and it's the warlords, it's the military-industrial complex in America, which has always supported wars everywhere for this reason. They supported the war in Afghanistan, and they supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Iraq, where, of course, you were born. The reason I mentioned the Nazis is because genocide at the World Court is so redolent of the Nazi experience, of course. I mean, Rwanda was one prior occasion, but of course it's the Holocaust that casts the shadow when one starts talking about genocide. It's 81 years since the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. A tenth of those who've been killed in Gaza were killed, of course. The use of the word resistance in the way media talks about it in Britain, where you live, how do you see the debate about what is justified as resistance? For some reason, your Prime Minister Sunak continues to say Israel has the right of self-defense, which, of course, it doesn't, given it's an occupying power. Do you think they understand the historical parallels? I promise it's the last Nazi comparison question. Do they understand the historical parallels with the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising?
They most probably do not understand the parallels, but nor do they understand international law, which is quite clear on the subject. Both Sunak and Starmer repeat parrot-like what Biden says. They never move one millimeter from the American position, and they keep repeating that Israel has the right to defend itself, but it doesn't, because under international law, you have the right to defend yourself if you are attacked by a state, but Hamas is not a state. Secondly, If the attack comes from an area that you occupy, then you don't have the right to self-defense. To put it simply, you don't have the right to self-defense against the people that you oppress. Moreover, it's Hamas, it's the Palestinians in Gaza who have the right to resist the occupation, including armed resistance. So international law is quite clear that Israel doesn't have the right to self-defense in this case.
What's the state of freedom in your country? Because you're an eminent scholar at Oxford University. I've talked to other Oxford professors on this program, actually, who talk about the scale of debate that's now permitted in Britain. What is your understanding of the freedom of speech in Britain and in Western Europe, given you mentioned Starmer, globally people won't know who he is, but he's the person who was promoted by Jeremy Corbyn, the then leader of the opposition Labour Party, and who says that things like what you've been telling me in this interview are anti-Semitic?
Israel has mounted a global campaign to delegitimize the supporters of BDS. Boycott, divestment, sanctions, which is a global grassroots campaign to end the occupation. And this is a non-violent global civil society campaign. It's non-violent, I stress that. And all the main demands of BDS are enshrined in international law. The right of return of the 1948 refugees, the right of Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel to equality, an end of occupation, that's the most important demand. All these are enshrined in international law. But Israel and its many friends around the world are conducting a campaign against critics of Israel, and they've weaponized anti-Semitism. And in Britain, the government has adopted the International Holocaust Memorial Association definition of anti-Semitism, and it's a non-definition. It's completely vacuous. And the definition itself is useless. It doesn't define anything. But then there are a series of 11 examples of what may constitute anti-Semitism. And seven of the 11 examples relate to Israel. The aim of this definition is not to protect Jews against anti-Semitism, but protect Israel against legitimate criticisms of the occupation. So anti-Semitism has been weaponized in Europe, in Germany, in America, and in the United Kingdom. And the government in this country has clamped down on pro-Palestinian protests.
Professor Avi Shaim, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Three Worlds, Memoirs of an Arab Jew, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Emeritus Professor of International Relations at Oxford University, Professor Avi Shaim, author of Three Worlds, Memoirs of an Arab Jew. Professor Shaim, we said in part one we were talking about this conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism in effect. Clearly, those countries that express solidarity with the Palestinians are suffering. Your birthplace, Baghdad, was bombed in the past few days, weeks by British and American bombers. Syria, of course, has been bombed. Yemen has been bombed. It's even more serious for countries that express solidarity than for scholars, dare I say it. Any examples that you personally have had that you've witnessed a lack of freedom and you're not being able to speak on these issues, or are you given free rein in the British media to tell us about your views as regards what we're witnessing as regards the Gaza genocide?
I've been a professor of international relations at Oxford for the last 36 years, and no one at my university has ever tried to restrict my freedom of expression, and I still enjoy, as I've always enjoyed, complete freedom to express my opinions, as I'm doing to you in this interview now. But the general picture in the country is not so sanguine. It's not the general picture is that the British government is extremely repressive, and it keeps passing legislation in order to restrict freedom of expression on Israel and on the Palestinian issue. And the government keeps giving the police more powers to clamp down on pro-Palestinian protests. The government, there was a major pro-Palestinian protest in London a few weeks ago. I went with my wife and my daughter. There were something like 800,000 demonstrators. I didn't see any hate, certainly no violence. There was a very good spirit of friendly spirit of solidarity with the Palestinians. But then Home Secretary Zuela Braverman said that this was a hate march and she wanted the police to stop the march. The police, to their credit, refused to. So we have an extremely repressive government, which is an enemy of civil rights and which is a blind supporter of Israel, totally uncritical supporter of Israel. And that is the situation here today. I cannot complain that my freedom has been restricted, but I've also had one encounter which is perhaps symptomatic of the growing intolerance for supporters of Palestine in this country. I was invited to give a lecture by Liverpool Hope University on the subject of my memoirs, and the title was Zionism and the Jews of Iraq, a Personal Perspective. Pretty obscure and narrow topic, and yet Jews in Liverpool complained to the university authorities that this would be unsafe, and my talk would raise problems of safety. And the university didn't ask me to cancel the lecture, but they asked me to postpone it. And I replied right away. I said, okay, I won't come now, and I will never come to your university, because this is not an issue of safety. It's an issue of academic freedom. So academic freedom in Britain is being eroded all the time for critics of Israel and for supporters of Palestinian rights. And the best example I can give you of this trend in Britain is the decline and fall of Jeremy Corbyn, the previous leader of the Labour Party, who was framed, who was accused of anti-Semitism, who was an anti-racist campaigner all his life, including opposing anti-Semitism. There wasn't any evidence against him.
Absolutely. He's actually been on this programme, and arguably he started firing people that were close to him on those faked, trumped-up anti-Semitism charges, it has to be said. On Israel, again, one of the arguable founding myths was that it was a safe place for Jews. So do you think, actually, given Israel is now arguably the most dangerous place in the world for Jews, do you think that the anti-Semites are really Netanyahu and those who enable his government, in that they conflate being Jewish with being Israeli?
I do think that. And Netanyahu is a very good example of this combination, because many of his friends are anti-Semites like Viktor Orban in Hungary, like the previous government in Poland, the previous government in Brazil. These were anti-Semites, but they're pro-Israel. And therefore, Netanyahu doesn't care about anyone who is anti-Semitic as long as they're pro-Israeli. And this reminds me of something that Theodor Herzl, the visionary of the Jewish state, wrote in his diary at the end of the 19th century. He said, the anti-Semites will become our strongest supporters. And we are seeing this phenomenon today, that Israel got mixed up with very nasty company. And this is a slightly different point. Israel supplies arms and cyber equipment and eavesdropping equipment on phones to a large range of countries around the world, including some of the most repressive regimes. So Israel plays a global role in supplying weapons and spyware to a large range of fascist countries.
You write about your background in Baghdad in your latest book. What does it make you feel knowing your government in Britain is bombing Iraq again?
I'm absolutely horrified by British policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this is just one example, a contemporary example, but the whole of British policy towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is complete nonsense. It's complete rubbish. It doesn't make any sense because Britain says that the two parties should negotiate directly a resolution of the conflict between them. But there haven't been any peace talks for 10 years. Israel, the present government, refuses to have any peace talks with the Palestinians. And to say the two parties should get together and resolve their own differences is like putting a lion and a rabbit in a cage and telling them to sort out their differences.
The two-state solution, you have changed a little now and recognize that actually only a one-state solution is possible. What do you feel when people completely ignore the idea of a one-state solution and continue to, as Joe Biden does, as NATO nation leaders continue to do? What is wrong with them going on and on about this two-state solution?
I used to support the two-state solution, which would have given a measure of justice to the Palestinians. And since 1967, there's been the broadest possible international consensus between a two-state behind the idea of a two-state solution. It has become fashionable to say that the two-state solution is dead. It is indeed dead because Israel killed it. Israel killed it by building settlements and expanding settlements on the West Bank and by annexing East Jerusalem, and by building the so-called separation wall on the West Bank. Separation wall is called by Arabs the apartheid wall. So Israel eliminated the possibility of a viable Palestinian state. All that is left to the Palestinians on the West Bank is enclave surrounded by Israeli settlements and military bases. So I say my starting point now is that the two-state solution is dead and Israel has killed it. I'll go further and say the two-state solution was never born. It was never born because no Israeli government since 1967 has ever offered a Palestinian state on terms that would be acceptable to the most moderate Palestinian leader, first of all. And secondly, no American government has ever pushed Israel into a two-state solution. So this is just a convenient phrase for people like Biden, Starmer, von der Leyen, and they keep banging on about a two-state solution. But the reality is that you can't have a two-state solution, and that's why I have changed my views, and now I support the only democratic solution to this conflict, which is one state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea with equal rights for all its citizens, regardless of nationality, of ethnicity, or religion.
Yeah, this is the only way. I think your police forces over there don't seem to realise that from the river to the sea means for Jews, Christians and Muslims. And just finally, you mentioned the apartheid wall. Nelson Mandela's strategy was, of course, violence. And the Great March of Return, the peaceful march, Great March of Return, resulted in tens of thousands killed by US, UK, EU armed weapons at that border apartheid wall. What would you do if you were a Palestinian teenager right now in Gaza? Would you go with Mandela or would you go with Gandhi?
I would go with Mandela, and I would put my trust in civil society because I have no confidence that the Western governments would change their position on Israel. But there is a gap, there is a disconnect between Western governments and their publics. The publics are increasingly pro-Palestinian. The demonstrations around the Arab world and the Islamic world and the rest of the world in support of the Palestinians. So public opinion is shifting very, very dramatically now because of the genocide in Gaza against Israel and in favor of the Palestinians. And therefore, I would, I think that the Palestinians, the only hope or the best hope is that public opinion will continue to change and the International Criminal Court will take action, will pursue its investigation of war crimes in the occupied territories, and that the International Court of Justice will eventually issue an opinion which would hold Israel to be guilty of genocide.
Professor Avi Schleim, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving the killing in Gaza, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen and Syria. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.